From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour might be misstating the story we're going to tell, because in many ways this hour is about possible missed connections or failing to recognize a connection. We're looking at depression and anxiety in our children, and in particular, we're looking at how we might diagnose and not miss the connection between what we might perceive as just, well, someone is feeling down or blue or sad or showing anxiety, and an actual situation where we can get a diagnosis. Well, we're not just talking about those classic teen symptoms, moody, etc. Actual depression, anxiety disorders, and the prevalence is a very important subject. Nearly 6%, from what I've read, and I'm sure our guests will connect me, have a severe anxiety disorder between the ages of 13 and 18. 25% or so of kids age 13 to 18 have some kind of anxiety disorder. And the Rochester Academy of Medicine is hosting an event on Wednesday night titled Behavioral Health, a Public Health Crisis, Understanding Pediatric Depression and Anxiety. This hour, my guests set the stage for that Wednesday night event right here on Connections. Let me welcome them now. Dr. Michael Scharf is here. He's the chief of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Scharf, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Eve Gotham is here. Eve is the Director of Child and Youth Services at Rochester Regional Health. Eve, nice to see you.
Nice to see you be here.
And also on the line with us is Dr. David Kay. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Buffalo, and we'll see him here Wednesday. Dr. Kay, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Glad to be here.
Doctor,
hello to everybody.
Hello. Great to have you here. Dr. Scharf and I were talking before the hour began that it is well outdated, at least a generation or more outdated, this idea that kids wouldn't be developed enough psychologically to have a diagnosable issue. But that used to be sort of the thought. You go back generations, and for a while it was this idea that, well, kids are different. Now we know that that's not the case. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right. And we have the benefit of a real increase in attention and the science and knowledge about the types of problems that children and adolescents suffer with, including anxiety and depression.
Okay.
That's what we're talking about.
All right. And Dr. Kay, you'll be here Wednesday night. What's the focus on Wednesday night in particular? Why are we calling this a public health crisis at this point?
Well, there's probably several reasons for that. Number one, as Dr. Scharf was just pointing out, we've really come to recognize these difficulties as being highly prevalent. They really do exist, and they really interfere substantially with kids' lives. So on the one hand, we have a big public health problem. On the other hand, we don't have enough people, professionals, to really address all the kids that need help. And we do that. We do know that the vast majority of kids with significant mental health problems don't receive any mental health treatment. And those who do receive mental health treatment, usually it's very limited. So for both of those reasons, there's a big problem, big public health problem, and secondly, we don't have enough people to take care of these problems, and there isn't enough access to mental health services.
Dr. Kay, let me ask, when you say we don't have enough people, it makes me wonder, where? Are we talking about in a school setting? Are we talking about in mental health services, wherever that service would be provided in that setting? Where don't we have enough people?
That's a really good question. So much of mental health attention does occur in the schools, and there's a variability in terms of how much training people have, how much expertise they have. Some schools have tremendous services, others have very little. But I was also thinking in particular of the of mental health specialists. There's limited numbers of child psychiatrists and other child mental health professionals, so that access to care is often very difficult, and the funding for a range of services is variable in communities. You know, obviously it's much better in the urban areas in Buffalo and Rochester, but once you get a little bit outside of those hubs, there's very, very little available.
All right, we're going to be asking the panel then to help us envision what the, quote, right number and right sort of scenario would look like if we can eventually get there. But first, I want to ask our guests in studio just to help outline the problems. I bring up depression, but, you know, it's a bit of a broader category of these kind of issues than that. So, Eve, what are we looking at? 13 to 18 especially, but what are we looking at? What are the various different either disorders or however you would categorize it?
Well, both depression and anxiety are families of different specific kind of difficulties that people might experience. So for anxiety, there's a more generalized anxiety, and then it can be much more specific. Social anxiety, specific phobias about different things, panic disorders. So you can go in both depression and anxiety from very general to very specific. And I think that is kind of what Dr. Scharf was saying. We've learned a lot, and so we know more specifically how to intervene with kids after we can do an assessment and understand what are some of the very much more specific things that are impacting them.
And I know some parents may be wondering, well, what really is, though, too young to be worried about depression, for example? When do we really start intervening in a serious way? What age? How often do we see that? And I'll start with Dr. Scharf. Can we kind of go around and talk about that?
Sure. The way you asked the question about what's too young or what's the age you should start worrying about, I wouldn't think of it that way.
Okay.
Instead, I think it's more appropriate to think about all the children and adolescent that are important to us in our lives, whether it be students, patients, family members, are on a developmental track. And we should always be trying to be mindful that they're on track. And for most of us, a relationship with a primary care doctor, a pediatrician or a family doc or nurse practitioner, is the way that we're checking in from birth about whether a child is on track. And so when there starts to be developmental delays or deviations, that's when you start to think of what could be going on. In terms of when we look to the construct of depression as it's currently defined, it really starts to be school age that we see more common cases of it. But I again, prefer that we take the stance of trying to keep people on track developmentally and not being satisfied till we understand when a deviation or delay occurs.
Okay. Eve, how would you address that?
I agree. I think that, you know, there, like you said at the very beginning, there is some mood dysregulation, I guess, in normal teenage development. So it's very important to look at development as a spectrum, and when things deviate from that spectrum or when certain symptoms get in the way of a child and or a teenager and their day-to-day life. There are activities that we consider developmentally appropriate. So if a child has difficulty going to school or participating in activities outside of school, then we would start to ask more questions, either first line of defense with our primary care physicians or seeking out a more specialized mental health treatment provider.
All right, I'd love to hear from our listeners on this. You can find us on Twitter at Evan Dawson or MMAC Media. Megan's the producer of the program. You can find both of us there. You can call the program toll-free 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And Dr. K, I don't want to be pessimistic, but when you say that we don't have enough people, it makes me wonder what it's going to take to change that and then what that does start to look like. So if I'm a parent and I've got a child, it's maybe hard enough for parents to try to start discerning what's the difference between normal ups and downs, normal moodiness that we all go through, let alone being a teenager or in middle school, which has got to be hard enough to begin with, and then starting to wonder, Is there something more here? Is this outside the bounds of sort of that typical ups and downs and moods in day to day, week to week, and then wondering, well, if it is, do we even have the right resources? So, where do we go next with this? Help us see where we should be going with this, Dr. K.
Okay. Well, in terms of the services and personnel needs and so forth, I work very closely with Dr. Scharf, and I know he has been working very hard to develop a white paper on this, so I'm going to let him answer that piece of things. But in terms of the other question of how is it that we determine that there's a problem, as the previous speakers have said, one of the major issues really is where does this interfere with the child's development and their life functioning? So we're looking for a constellation of symptoms. So, for example, in depression, you usually see a child who's very irritable or who's very sad, and it's very persistent, and usually their sleep is impaired, and oftentimes their appetite is impaired, their concentration is impaired. But you also see that this is interfering with their life. So, for example, at school, they aren't as motivated in school. They may be more irritable with teachers and classmates. They don't have the attention span to do the academic work that they were doing before. Their grades fall, and so forth. At home and in the family, you start to hear much more in the way, perhaps, of conflict. Again, that irritability shows up and interferes with their functioning in the family. So what we end up looking for is a group of symptoms that tend to cluster together along with an impairment in the child's functioning. And as we talked about before, as I was mentioning before, these kinds of difficulties interfere substantially with kids' development and with their functioning. In fact, we know that the top five reasons for what's considered to be childhood disability are all mental health related. So, again, just highlighting the importance of these problems.
Okay. Again, listeners, we're getting some of your comments online as well. Some have already emailed some questions. We're going to be getting to some of those as we go throughout the hour. But I do want to remind you what's coming up on Wednesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. It's Behavioral Health, a Public Health Crisis, Understanding Pediatric Depression and Anxiety. And that event is where? Let me ask our guests in the studio to let us know what's coming up on Wednesday.
Oh, this will be at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. And we're very hopeful that this will be an awareness-raising session, but also lead to what can we do in terms of next steps. An important audience we're really trying to reach here is primary care providers, because as issues of access were raised, and we look at our community here in Rochester and the broader region, including rural communities near here, as Dr. Kay said, there aren't enough child psychiatrists to treat everyone. And if we think about what people need and what they can benefit from, not everyone needs to see a child and adolescent psychiatrist. But having some sort of community and structure and way that parents and families and youth themselves can make sense of what's going on and what do we need is really important. And that community, in terms of contact at an individual level, has to be rooted in schools and in primary care. And that's a lot of the work that Dr. Kay and I referred to how we work so closely. A lot of the work we're doing is with a program called CAPPC, which stands for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Primary Care, to provide education and immediate consultation to primary care providers so that when they're faced with a mental health issue in youth, they can immediately speak to a child psychiatrist. And we conceived that program about 6 years ago and been running it and have been very pleased with the outcomes we've had in terms of ability to improve access for folks.
Okay, so if we could, I just want to get at least one listener question in because time's about to fall short for Dr. Kay, who's got to leave us at the half-hour mark here. But Jake writes a question on the question of peer reporting. He wants to know, are there any efforts to boost peer reporting? Adults may miss the signs, but their peers probably don't, but are unaware of the conditions or who to tell without judgment. So are there any efforts to work on peer reporting in this kind of setting? Dr. Scharf, I'll start with you. Eve, go ahead.
Well, thank you. This really varies from community to community. And the most important part of that question that I heard was issues about judgment and concerns of who can I tell and how will it be handled in a way that is appropriate, attending to potential safety issues often, but also respectful of the person's privacy and needs. School counselors, if I was trying to pick one place where peers generally have access to the same helping adults, school counselors is usually a reliable place to start. Sometimes it's clergy, youth group leaders, or just some family in a community you're in who's a respected community member or an adult. The language that's developing to refer to folks as natural helpers include some of these wise community members.
One of my concerns, and I'll ask Eve and Dr. K to weigh in on this, would be when we're talking about whether it's peer reporting or these various individuals, but especially on peer reporting, I think Jake makes an important point. The friends may be able to notice that something is different or concerning, mm-hmm. but they don't have the medical training to understand exactly what that means. So they may know something is off, but they may not know, you know, how to help diagnose them. And that's sure. very difficult, mm-hmm. isn't it?
It is. And I think a lot of schools have really developed very structured programs, anti-bullying type of programs that involve peers. And I think those same youth are key also in kind of bridging this gap with mental health. You know, they're trained to listen, they're trained to intervene, they're trained to not keep secrets. And those are often the interventions that we talk about with the teenagers we treat. Who are your friends that won't keep a secret? Who are your friends that will go to your parents? Who are your friends that will tell a teacher or someone at school that you're struggling? Because those are the friends that we want to involve in this picture of how we're going to help you.
And yet, here's an email from Mark, and I was going to get there later, but you brought up bullying. Mark wrote and he said, I hope that you'll bring up bullying. He said, essentially, he thinks that we've gone too far, that kids are soft, that we are not actually helping kids by telling them that anyone who calls you a name is bullying you, and we're teaching them to be victims. That was an email from Mark this morning. He said, didn't know if it would come up. Eve, you brought up bullying.
Sure.
What would you say to a listener like Mark?
So you know, I would kind of say that's a difficult question to answer easily. Our world has changed. So where bullying may, a number of years ago, been either a verbal altercation between youth or even a physical altercation between youth, with the emergence of social media, the game has changed, so to speak, with bullying. And I think that it's much easier to, when you are not face-to-face with someone, the filter goes away. And kids are engaging in conversations that would alarm any of us as adults, in the topics that they're talking about, sexting, pictures. And so I think bullying has taken on a very different picture from the playground bullying of past. But we also, you know, I think the point from the comment is that we also do need to teach kids skills. We need to be teaching kids conflict resolution skills and social skills. And, you know, we can get really off topic, but there's good and bad to some of the changes in education. And where kids in preschool and kindergarten used to learn social skills, with some of the new academic rigor, some of those softer things of social skills are less prominent in the curricula.
Dr. K, before I let you go, do you want to weigh in on Mark's point there? He thinks he doesn't like what we're seeing with all this anti-bullying.
Well, I would echo what you just said. And, you know, as with any kind of social kind of movement, at first, you know, we didn't recognize it at all. We ignored it, and it was really a big, big problem. Now we, you know, maybe in some ways gone to the other side of the pendulum, and we are looking for it every place we can find. I think overall that's a good thing. Kids do need to learn resiliency, conflict resolution, anger management kinds of skills as well. And so I think that the point there is you know, there is something to what the caller is saying. But I wouldn't lose sight of the fact that the major thrust of this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. This is something that was really quite ignored, and, you know, boys will be boys and so on. And really, as we've seen with some of the high-profile situations where there have been suicides and so forth, this is not something we ought to tolerate.
Doctor, and I'm going to have Dr. Scharf jump in. I just want to let Dr. K get out of here because I know everyone's got a very tight schedule here. So some final thoughts as you head out the door here, Dr. K. We'll see you on Wednesday night. But what do you hope comes out of the Wednesday night discussions and the event here?
I hope that there will be a better understanding of anxiety and depression in kids, as Dr. Scharf mentioned, consciousness raising about, you know, what is it that we're actually talking about, when is it a problem, and what to do about it.
Dr. K, thanks very much for your time, and we'll see you Wednesday night.
Thank you all.
Dr. David K is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Buffalo, and my guest for the remainder of the hour here in studio will also be there Wednesday night. You've been hearing Eve Gotham, who is the Director of Child and Youth Services at Rochester Regional Health, and Dr. Michael Scharf, Chief of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at URMC. You wanted to weigh in on the question of anti-bullying.
I do. Thank you. You know, I hear Mark's question, and the part I resonate with is the term bully is used so frequently as a clinician in a clinical setting. When a family or patient comes to me and uses that word, I don't know what it means. I need more details to sort it out. And at the same time, I've seen the kids who've survived suicide attempts in the context of bullying situations, including online bullying, such as Eve talked about, which goes even farther than some of the examples Eve mentioned, encouraging people to hurt themselves or kill themselves. So there are clearly situations of extreme cruelty, and that's a word I often use, is cruelty, that happen and really hurt people. Now, as Dr. K said, our approach as a field of mental health services and the multiple disciplines involved, it has evolved. And while the term bullying can be used to mean different things, there's a variety of approaches to addressing it out there. The most current evidence-based state-of-the-art includes teaching youth to be assertive. And if you look at the Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry website, there's resources about bullying, and it talks about teaching assertiveness in there. I don't know if that's satisfying to Mark or others with a similar concern, but it is something we're aware of and try to address. But there is this tension between, you know, promoting toughness might be one term versus preventing these really horrible outcomes we're concerned about.
Sure, and you used the term evidence-based. I heard there was actually quite a long conversation among various members, not only of the media but also outside the media. On social media a couple weeks ago, there was the story of a 12-year-old girl who who died by suicide, and the question of bullying came up. And some local media members were sort of engaging with some readers and listeners online, saying that, you know, where's the evidence that bullying and suicide are connected? And my answer was, I don't know. I mean, I was sort of an observer in that conversation. What do we see in terms of evidence in regards to modern bullying? And I say modern bullying because Eve pointed out it is more immediate. You know, you can't just, if you avoid somebody on the way home from school, you used to be able to not see them for the rest of the day. And you can't always do that anymore. Mm-hmm. So modern bullying and suicide, do we see evidence-based connection?
Well, I'll speak to that again. The trying to sort through with numbers isn't entirely satisfying. What we do see is bullying will come up as one of multiple stressors or risk factors that contributes to suicide attempts and suicides. In terms of looking at it as the only cause in a certain percentage of youth, we don't really have satisfying data about that. But a contributing factor in a significant number is found over and over. The specific concerns, another way to look at this, might be to talk even more generally about trauma. We've been talking for almost a half hour now, and we haven't talked about trauma. Dr. K did mention resiliency, which is the other side of what we're trying to do when we talk about trauma, promote resiliency. So a number of youth may have experienced many traumas and losses through life, and then the bullying happens at a time of risk. That's what we're particularly concerned about. So it's not that bullying however we mean that term, is the only thing that causes these suicides.
Absolutely.
It's in the context of a life with multiple challenges and traumas. This is another one, sometimes a severe life-threatening one.
All right, so we've had a number of listener questions on separate issues. You know, is depression genetic? How, when will it manifest with kids? What should parents who have depression be thinking about if when they're raising kids? We had questions on, are we overdiagnosing? Before we get to all of that, and I do want to talk about the connection between trauma and anxiety and depression, et cetera. Let me grab a phone call. This is Jenna in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Jenna.
I think to that point about trauma, as parents in this age of new bullying, we're not equipped to teach our children resiliency in an era of online and digital bullying, and I'll give you a couple of examples. My son was in middle school. He was in sixth grade. And on the bus, he was being bullied, but I wasn't aware of it. I was seeing more anger at home, more acting out. And finally, and this is my kid who was previously described as the mayor of his school. And I finally figured out, I saw him on the bus one day, getting off the bus, and he threw his backpack, and he was screaming at the bus. And I ran out on the lawn, and I figured out that he was being bullied. And I said to him, what happened? And a child on the bus had told him to set himself on fire and die and not come back to school. Now, I'm lucky, and I was able to call the principal and call the superintendent of our school, and within a matter of hours have his bus changed. I was very lucky. But that didn't change the trauma that it inflicted on him and how it impacted his behavior. Another quick example, outside of my family, a friend, child was sexually molested. Her peers became aware of that information, and she became pursued online, bullied. My son, as I look through his cell phone, I can text after text after text, threads of text, kick messengers, just conversations among peers, things that we were never exposed to, Evan. And as you try to talk to your kids about these conversations and about how to conduct yourself appropriately, who's your friend, who's your not, what's okay, what's not, what we're not equipped as parents, I don't think, is to teach that resiliency. And when I reach out to doctors to try and make appointments, I can tell you there's a URMC therapist that I've been told is among the best for family therapy. I can't get an appointment. She's booked. She's not taking new patients. Where do we go? Where do we turn for help? Because the school counselors are not equipped to handle this. So where do we go?
Yeah,
what
Jenna,
do we do?
Jenna, thank you for the phone call. Dr. Scharf, you want to start? Eve, wherever you want
sure.
to go here.
Jenna, those are both powerful examples, and I'm really sorry for the suffering that your son and your family's gone through. There's not one simple solution to this. I alluded to the idea of building resilient communities. I hear and resonate with the feeling that school counselors aren't equipped to address all of the mental health issues that result from trauma. But I do think it's reasonable to look to schools and school counselors to help address developing the culture and developing information for parents about how to handle bullying and what's common in your school. If you haven't identified a therapist or specialist in mind, it is more common than not that there's a long delay or it's difficult to see them. We've talked about access issues, and there's a number of ways to look at this, from wait lists at clinical services to the number of child psychiatrists in town, how many are in private practice, and almost none are accepting new patients at any point in time if you call. If you are able to connect either in a private practice or in a clinic setting, the average wait to see a child psychiatrist is typically 12 weeks if you connect. So the point from that is not to create a hopeless... Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Jenna.
...of testing in our school district, the beginning of testing, if I were to call now.
Say again, Jenna, go ahead.
If I were to call now, 12 weeks for a first appointment means I'm looking at the beginning of testing. So the beginning of when they would be taking their tests, their New York State test, 12 weeks from now, that's what we're looking at, right? 4 months from now would be the beginning of their New York State test. I couldn't take them out of school legally.
That's a perfect point, and it's part of the
that's
point I'm making.
Point.
That's not acceptable.
It is such a struggle.
It is a struggle, but part of the point is that you then can't count on the providers that you'd have to wait 4 months to see. Not everyone's going to see a child psychiatrist, and certainly not promptly. And that's not awesome, but it's probably okay. What I mean by that is there are other providers that you could see quicker. So the I alluded to the work that Dr. Kay and I and others have been doing to educate and enhance the capacity of primary care doctors to do more initial assessments, to triage more effectively who needs to see the psychiatrist who can have treatment started in a primary care setting, or see a different a specialist, a therapist. And there are a great number of excellent therapists in our community, some in private practice and some working at agencies, both at U of R and at Rochester Regional Health. And lest we look to provincial, Rochester Regional Health is the largest provider of outpatient mental health services for children and youth right now.
And I think Dr. Scharf makes an excellent point, is that there are many skilled therapists who can really assess the situation and give some advice as to how to connect with a psychiatrist if that's the recommended course.
And
the good news is there's lots of...
Can we make one distinction, too, between therapist, psychiatrist, and talk therapy? Because I think there's an important difference between simply a psychiatrist who's looking to prescribe and someone who's actually going to do talk therapy for these children and families to create solutions. I just think that there's a really important distinction. And I'll hang up and let you guys finish the conversation. I think it's, again, really important. And I know my family's been affected. And I think one of the important things that Evan brought up earlier is just the difference between when we all grew up and bullying now that pursues you. You can't leave it at school and go home and be with your family and get some respite. It pursues you at home throughout your evening, your afternoon. You just can't get away from it.
So. Yeah,
Jenna, thank you. Thank you for the phone call. Go ahead, Eve.
So, I mean, I think she Jenna brought up some such great points for us to continue our discussion. But I do think that there are, what I was going to say is there are lots of, you know, medicine is definitely one route, which can be very effective. You know, therapy and in particular cognitive behavior therapy, as we talk about depression and anxiety, is a very effective treatment. And for some youth, the combination of the two becomes the most effective route. So, you know, there are different spectrums and intent levels of intensity for treatment, depending on, again, the constellation of symptoms that you see when you first meet a child in their family. And really, I think a distinction of child mental health is that you are not just treating the child. When you treat a child in any of our settings, you're treating both the child and their entire family.
Okay, we're late for a break. We're going to come back and continue this discussion because we have so many other things to try to get through in the next 20 minutes or so with Eve Gotham, who's the Director of Child and Health Services at Rochester Regional Health, and Dr. Michael Scharf, Chief of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at URMC. They will be there on Wednesday night, 6 to 8 p.m., and tickets are $10 for the general public. If you want to attend, they are talking about what they call a public health crisis, understanding pediatric depression and anxiety. That is going to be where, Dr. Scharf, on Wednesday night?
At the Rochester Academy of Medicine.
You can jump online at raom.org for more information there. Short break and more of your questions answered next. Coming up in our second hour, it's our monthly science roundtable focused on climate and global cooling. Global cooling millions of years ago. Scientists are exploring the mystery of what caused global cooling about 3.5 million years ago. And what are the implications for what might be going on our planet today? That is next hour in our monthly science roundtable.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Shepherd Ford, serving the greater Rochester region since 1948, offering new and pre-owned cars, trucks, and SUVs, including hybrids. Located on Routes 5 and 20 in Canandaigua and online at shepherdford.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Dr. Scharf, you wanted to add to what we've been talking about here?
I do. We were talking about different providers, and I just want to make clear, I think the important point for someone in Jenna's situation trying to get help for a child, really for anyone, is to look for the best assessment possible. And a comment was made about psychiatrists and medication versus psychotherapy. Certainly my identity as a child and adolescent psychiatrist is to do complete full assessments and not be biologically reductionistic or just about medicine, but in fact do biopsychosocial spiritual formulations and interventions. And whether I'm doing the psychotherapy myself or in collaboration with another clinician, seeing that child psychiatrist is often critical for the assessment, not every element of the care. I just wanted to make that part clear.
Okay, a couple of listener points here. If you missed it earlier, one of our listeners named Mark was concerned about what he sees as too much of an anti-bullying movement because he thinks we are overgeneralizing the term bullying, and he said he essentially thinks we're making kids soft. Harriet writes to us in response to that. She writes, hello, Evan. Unlike Mark, whom I do not agree with, I find young people much more tender and kind to others than they have ever been before, and interestingly, more aware of what it means to bully. We have more new ways to bully one another with online media so available, but kids are stepping up. The idea that kids need to be tougher seems to play right into a bullying mentality, and with the violence and ugliness that we so often see in the world, toughness should come from considerate, thoughtful behavior, not brutishness, and this is true strength. By not retaliating to others' bad behavior. So that's from Harriet. And I want to get Deb's question in. Deb brings up a question on treatment and drugs. Deb says, what percentage of childhood depression is the cause of medications for other disorders? Is the fix more medication? I worry about so many of our children and teens growing up with a cocktail of medications to regulate their thoughts and actions. That's from Deb. I want to add, before I let our panelists respond to that, I want to add a point that came up in my own preparation for this program. Earlier this year, we talked to the author of a book that's become very popular called All the Bright Places by Jennifer Niven. And it's a teen literature. It is almost on the par of John Green and some of the work he's been doing. And Jennifer came to Rochester. I think Writers and Books had her, if I remember correctly. And the book is about a teenage relationship about two young people who have depression. It's about the way they work together to deal with that. But I didn't know until we had that conversation just how viscerally some listeners took that book, because the book the criticism is the book stigmatizes the very notion of taking medication because the characters feel like it turns them into sort of listless, emotionless drones as opposed to actual thinking, expressing people. And so they view that as what adults want them to do, not what should be done, and they kind of bash it. And so some readers have responded to that saying, boy, you kind of attack the idea of getting on medication when a lot of kids do need it. And so here's Deb asking the question, are we sure they need it? Does it cause other disorders? You know, should we be careful about it? It's a complex question. Dr. Scharf, I'll start with you.
Thank you for letting me address that
first.
This is something I'm actually quite passionate about, okay. And it underscores the last point I just made, which is about getting a good enough assessment. The majority of psychiatric medications are not prescribed by psychiatrists. They're prescribed by primary care doctors. They're prescribed by other specialists. And this has to do with combination of problems with access and also stigma about seeing a psychiatrist. Some people are more content to see their primary care doctor and get a medication and not see the specialist. The work I do is highly specialized just in terms of the different roles I have. So I don't mean to represent it as what every psychiatrist does, but I actually stop medications as often as I start them in the consultations that I do. And for the topics that we said we'd talk about today, depression and anxiety, the first-line treatment for anxiety disorders is psychotherapy, is not medication. And, again, that's really clear and well-established in the field. And so the idea of getting a good assessment and having the treatment come from that really is critical. I'm also, at the risk of overreacting to part of one of the comments, the way that we have a tendency to talk about psychiatric medications as one thing is kind of silly and reflects some of the stigma and lack of knowledge. Would we talk about all of medicine as one thing? Would we talk about Tylenol as the same as chemotherapy? It's kind of ridiculous at face value, right? And yet there is a way that we talk about psychiatric medications as if they're all the same thing. They're not. They're very different. And some medications can have as a side effect for some people apathy or a dulling of emotions. and that would be a problem and a reason to change the treatment. Mm-hmm. And others don't. So meds are really different. The problems are really different. And, you know, going back to the whole point of having this talk and the further conversation on Wednesday is to raise awareness. This is a big deal. It's a big issue affecting a lot of youth. It's also complicated. And if a similar thing was happening with pediatric cancer, where 20%, only 20% of youth with mental health disorders, if only 20% of youth with cancer ever saw an oncologist, our society would not stand for that.
So, again, back to the numbers, I think I saw 25, just over 25% of kids aged 13 to 18 are thought to have some kind of either pediatric depression, anxiety, et cetera. Yes? Something around the...
Yeah, so the most accepted number is 20% of youth under 18 will meet criteria for some diagnosis. That includes ADHD, it includes autism, so it includes a wide variety
of diagnoses.
But most of them diagnoses.
Don't get any sort of treatment?
Yeah, 20% have a diagnosable psychiatric condition, and only 20% ever see a mental health provider.
20%
only 20%
of the 20%.
Correct. And in terms of the different numbers, that 20% is at any point in time. The 25% you're alluding to includes people who have a specific incident happen, grief, loss, and they're symptomatic for a short period of time, but not continuously from age 13 to 18.
Okay, but that's still 1 in 6, just around 1 in 6, 16% of kids 13 to 18 aren't getting a diagnosis for something they need a diagnosis for. That's mm-hmm. that's a
right.
lot.
Yeah.
That is a lot of kids. And what I just heard from Dr. Scharf is, and I to Deb, listener who wrote in that question, I understand the concern, but maybe we should not speak about pediatric medication or depression medication,
right.
those kind of things, very monolithically. The way
right.
we can.
Oh, it's a real concern. It's a real concern to me in a lot of the consultation work that I do. But all the meds are not the same.
Okay. And for the people who, for example, reacted to Jennifer Niven's book, and I understand why. I mean, that's a very emotional thing. That book focused on things like suicide. I mean, that's a very sensitive mm-hmm. Kind of book. It seems like Dr. Scharf is saying some medications can dull the emotions and those senses, and then if that happens, we should be looking for other options.
Right.
You know, so that doesn't mean like, well, drugs don't work for you or drugs always do this to you.
Exactly.
Just like for me, migraines don't always get fixed by one thing, and I try something else. Some things make me sort of loopy. Some
right.
things make me a little dizzy. Some things do not.
Right.
So and for some, emotions can be a good thing. You know, for most of us, emotions can be a good thing. But too much emotion can cause problems. Mm-hmm. And I think it, again, speaks to, you know, keeping everything in that middle ground. To one extreme or the other extreme, it can cause problems in people's lives.
Girls more likely than boys to have these kinds of challenges? Yes or no?
Yes. The way we've defined them is anxiety disorders and depressive disorders. Girls are more likely to suffer with them. Boys who suffer from trauma and emotional distress are more likely to act out behaviorally. So in terms of exposure to trauma and it having any impact, boys and girls can both have significant impact. Girls tend to, this is a broad generalization, have more anxiety and depression, their symptoms being inward focused, as we say, and boys tend to have more externalizing type of behaviors.
Let me grab a phone call, and this is Mike in Rochester. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, good afternoon. The 20% number that was just put up, where's that diagnosis coming from, and where's the origin of that diagnosis from? Because I question the 20%. Is this first obtained at the school level? Is this from parents taking their child in? Is this, you know, I'm very curious where 20% comes from.
Well, I can speak to that. There's a number of epidemiologists who look at diagnoses and they look at a variety of settings. I think in terms of getting to what you're asking, a key point is some sort of functional impairment to qualify for a diagnosis. But it is a broad variety of conditions. Again, it includes everyone with ADHD, everyone with autistic spectrum disorder, everyone with depression, everyone with anxiety disorder. So it's a broad array of diagnoses that come to clinical attention. When epidemiologists try to to specify the numbers, they look at things like billing reports, prescription rates, then controlled studies where you interview everyone in a small population and then you try to extrapolate to a larger population. So that number comes from all of those types of analysis.
And I think some of the larger studies have come from very large organizations like the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institutes of Health. So groups and researchers that are looking at broad and differing populations of people in America.
All right, trying to keep it moving. Here's a mom in Irondequoit writing in. What about the over-reliance on medication, over-talk therapy in the psychiatric community? She says, my daughter was always told when the meds are right, she will move forward. Until she got into strong behavioral health and behavioral therapy and off the meds, did she start to show improvement? I know it's hard to...
Well, I don't know if I stopped her meds, but I think that's a ringing endorsement of the point I made earlier.
And treatment is individual. So everyone has different experiences. And so her point is well taken that for some, it may be, you know, more that the therapy is the effective part and less meds. For others, it may be less of one and more of the other. And I think that speaks to what Dr. Scharf and I were saying about a thorough assessment with a multidisciplinary team who can give different perspectives and see the child and the family as a whole, including their primary care physician, who's a really important piece for the background history and noticing changes. That's the thing about kids is that they're all different. They're at different places in their development. They're at different places biologically with puberty and all those other things that really make it. That's why it is a specialty because there's so many different variables.
I think I can make a point quickly related to this as well. If you try to think of these things the way we think of other problems, because that's how psychiatrists are trained to do it. If you have a diabetes meds that doesn't work, you switch, you try something else. And sometimes lifestyle changes are adequate for early forms or for pre-diabetic conditions. If we look at people suffering, our children suffering with depression or with anxiety, if 2/3 could get some benefit from a medication, there's a lot of different ways you could look at that. That means, 1/3 won't. But it also means if the youth in front of you is one of the ones who could, do you want to withhold it from him or her? And so the idea of, again, having a good assessment, trying to take a sophisticated approach, and then really, we talk about these numbers, and it refers to large populations, but then when you have one person in front of you following what really happens.
I knew we were going to run out of time before I hit everything I wanted to. I know some people might be wondering then. I think it's a totally reasonable point that, again, if it's 2/3 and 1/3 and 1/3, but how long until we get a pretty good idea? What's the sample size of time we need before we start saying, okay, this medication is quote-unquote working or having an effect, and this is not?
Longer than you'd think.
Well, for some
medicines, a year,
not that long.
So it depends on the med. There isn't one answer. It depends on the medication. So stimulant medication, for example, you can actually tell in a couple days. Of course,
a couple of days.
Pharmacologically, if you look at what's happening in real life, Tuesday might be different than Wednesday. So you should probably wait a week to really say, just because of the variation in day to day and normal life.
But that's not months. That's not a year.
That's not for stimulants. For antidepressants, 4 to 6 weeks. And usually if someone's going to get better, you start to see some response even earlier after just a couple of weeks. But 4 to 6 weeks for a trial an antidepressant.
Okay. And this is just, we barely even touched Trump. We got a minute left. I'm just going to ask this. I know people in my own life who have depression, did not grow up with any trauma, but they have clinical depression. And sometimes people in their life say, but your life is so good. Why aren't you happy? And of course that's what depression is. In other cases, trauma can induce or lead to pediatric anxiety, depression. Yes, and does.
Absolutely.
How often? Do we know what percentage of these cases are sort of trauma rooted?
We could talk for an hour about.
I was going to say that may be another show.
One partial answer would be to say that major depressive disorder happens as often in response to severe trauma as post-traumatic stress disorder does.
Yeah.
There's a whole book of things that can happen in response to trauma. It's called the DSM. Almost everything that we deal with, trauma interacts, how it prevents and how severe it is.
Because my brain then goes to thinking, I don't want this just to be a conversation about privilege. You're privileged enough to recognize this. Imagine kids in poverty. Imagine kids who have seen violence or crime or drugs or have couch surfed and haven't had stability, and then try to think about the fact they might not be diagnosed and people don't know why they're acting out or dealing with this or not showing up. Mm-hmm. Is it logical to wonder all of those things?
Absolutely. Yes. And we see significant health disparities. Poverty impacts them even in our region. And we do look at violence. We've been talking about depression outcomes like suicide. Suicide, which is the second leading cause of death in 14 to 25-year-olds. Homicide is the third, and depending on the demographic, it switches where homicide's the second.
All right, well, that probably is a separate hour, and it should be. We ought to talk about that, because I don't want this just to be a suburbs conversation.
Very important.
Wednesday night, raom.org. You can still get tickets, learning much more about pediatric depression and anxiety. Dr. Scharf, Eve Gotham, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you
for having us.
Science Roundtable's next.